Emilio.
I did. I'm going to see him next time I'm back there. I wasn't able to see him that time. But no, I'm very excited about him. And then I had a few other people recommend him as well. So
yeah, that he is very exceptional.
Yeah, yeah. But I spoke with Walter Ahrensberg.
Oh, sure.
And I have a phone interview with Elizabeth Newhouse coming
up pretty soon. That's Teddy Landreth. She was Elizabeth Landreth.
Right.
That was
right.
her maiden name.
Right. I interviewed her sister, Anne, in Boston also.
Yes, Anne.
And then Sylvia Upman Munero.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. It was a productive week, but...
She married a dentist.
Yeah, he's a nice
Munero.
Guy.
Yeah, Frank. Very nice guy.
But...
Frank Munero.
Yeah. No, there is a little community there. Incidentally,
I'll just tell you something now that I'm signing my name. I signed George P. Montalban. Okay. As you have seen, I'm George Plinio Montalban. In Cuba, nobody knew that my first name was George. Wow. I was Plinio Montalban to everybody.
Wow.
When I came here in 1960, I went to California.
Yeah.
And I decided it would be too tough to go around at that time.
Sure.
You know, today people are more cosmopolitan, so it wouldn't have been a problem. Or it would have been less of a problem. So I said, well, my first name is George, so I'll introduce myself to everybody as George, which is what I did. And the result of that was a lot of confusion.
Yeah.
Because when I came to Washington from the West Coast, I introduced myself as George Montalban.
Yeah.
And I quickly found some friends that I had in Cuba who were living in Washington. I said, you're George, you're Plinio. So I thought...
Wow. No, it's interesting, this American, is it, like, what is it, my grandparents are Ellis Island, and their names got changed from Yankel Yankovich to Jack Fine. I don't know how you get from one to the other, but this process of assimilation takes many forms, I feel like. So tell me about your family, if we could start there. Yeah, how do you end up with a name like George Montalban?
Okay, well, my parents, right? My mother was American. She was born in Richmond, Virginia in 1913. Passed away around 2004 or 5.
Oh, wow.
My father was Cuban, born in Cienfuegos in 1905. And he passed away in Havana in January 1950.
Oh, wow.
At age 44.
So you were very young.
I was 7 and a half due to coronary heart disease. He was a doctor. He was chief resident at the Wilmer Eye Clinic at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. And... you know, Baltimore and Washington are kind of twin cities. So he met my mother, who was a nurse, in the 1930s, I think around 1935 or 36, in Baltimore, Washington. And they married, and he became director of postgraduate study at Manhattan Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat in New York.
Wow.
And my sister was born in 1941, and I was born in 1942 in New York. But shortly after I was born, he had a first heart attack. And at that time, there was really nothing to be done about heart disease. Very, very little that could be done other than diet and things like that. And so the recommended path for him was to go back down to Cuba. So we went back down to Cuba in very early 1943. And by the way, he registered me as a Cuban citizen once we got down there, so I had dual citizenship by birth.
And that was allowed?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I lived in Cuba from the time I was 6 or 7 months old until I was 18. I left in September 1960.
Wow. Did your father go to school in the United States?
Well, he was a graduate of the medical school at the University of Havana in 1926. And then he did his residency. He was chief resident at the Wilbur Eye Institute at Johns Hopkins
University. Just remained.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now he was born in Cienfuegos,
right,
in Cuba.
Yeah, yeah.
And he came from a pretty large family. Both his parents died in Cienfuegos. I'm not sure exactly where they were born. Actually, I'm doing genealogical research, but the Cuban part is still very sparse because I've been trying to work without using a Cuban researcher. Now I've gotten in touch with a Cuban researcher, and she's going to help me get the documents and names and things like that. But anyhow, he was the youngest of a very large family.
Wow.
They had, let's put it this way, more than six kids. I don't know how many, but he was the youngest, and he was born in 1905.
Wow. And what was the family business?
Well, his father had a pharmacy.
Okay.
In Cienfuegos.
Okay.
I can't tell you that he was a pharmacist. I don't know. But I know that the pharmacy was his.
Sure, sure. It's just interesting that he ended up in the United States. Was that a common path?
Well, he, you know, when he graduated from the medical school at the University of Havana in 1926. And at that time, a good option was to join the medical corps of the Cuban Army, which he did. And then he heard about fellowships being offered in aviation medicine. That was what it was called at the time, aviation medicine, at a school in McAllen Field in Texas. And he won the scholarship or fellowship. And aviation medicine was what is today called ophthalmology. Although if you Google that, Facebook won't tell you that. Wikipedia will say that now is aerospace medicine, but I mean, not really. They jumped.
Yeah.
Okay. Aviation medicine at that time was really ophthalmology. And so from there, he went to the Wilmer Eye Institute at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. His picture is on the wall.
That's incredible.
At Hopkins.
Yeah. Were you close with the rest of your Cuban family when you returned?
Yes, although one aunt lived in Cienfuegos, and she had two children, first cousins of mine, and they were also in Cienfuegos. So saw them at Christmas, saw them assorted times through the year, but not as frequently as our relatives in Havana.
So most of them had moved to Havana. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Were they? I mean, I'm trying to figure out, like, because it's what it took to kind of be in this American, Anglo-American community, right? And so clearly your father, having lived in the United States for a long time, having married a American woman, would have been included in this Anglo-American colony, community, whatever. Were other members of your family considered a part of this community or not really?
My sister.
And why?
Well, after my father, prior to my father dying, yeah. I don't really remember the people who populated their social circle. I suspect that they were mainly Cubans,
okay.
not Americans. When my father died in January 1950, then my mother, I know, really developed her American friends.
Yeah.
I mean, the option for her at that time was, do we stay in Cuba or do we move to the States? My grandparents were in Washington, D.C. So she had that option and that option remained open, I would say, for about 2 or 3 years, because with my father's life insurance, she bought a house in Arlington where my grandparents lived in Arlington, Virginia.
Yeah.
And we would come and visit them in Arlington, Virginia. So, but both my sister and I wanted to stay in Cuba, and so we stayed in Cuba, I suppose, because we had friends and so on.
Yeah.
So she really developed a lot of friends in the American community in Cuba, and she and my sister really knew that colony backwards and forwards. They could give you, and my sister lives in Sarasota, they could give you a lot of information about that colony. I, on the other hand, had mainly Cuban friends. I began to play tennis. I, modesty aside, got quite good at it. And that was the circle that I ran in, so
at Badalo or where?
Well, no, at Villanova University,
okay.
in Havana, but a lot of the tournaments were at the Badalo Tennis Club.
Sure. Was there any question that you would go to an American school?
I don't think so.
So that was, even if your father had lived?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. My father wanted to put me in a Cuban school. This is what I recall that my mother told me. And he was thinking of Baldor, mm-hmm. a school named Baldor. But my father had renounced the Catholic Church. I really don't know the reason, except that my mother told me that he was very disappointed in the way priests in Cuba handled poverty. But I can't even say any more than that.
Right.
And Baldor was a Catholic school. And so when he asked whether religion would be part of the report card, and they said yes, that was the end of that. And so they put me in Columbus School, which was a non-denominational kind of Cuban-American school in Havana. And then, after my father died, my mother put me at Ruskin Academy.
There were other Americans in Columbus?
I don't know.
Okay. Was it all boys?
No.
Okay.
It was co-ed.
And your sister went there as well?
No, I think she went to St. George.
Okay. Yeah. Why do you think it is that you Was tennis really the primary factor in you kind of finding a home in the Cuban community more than the Anglo-American community?
Yes.
Yeah?
Probably. Yeah. I was also very close to my Cuban relatives.
Okay.
And I really didn't find much interesting about the American. I mean, this is justified or not.
Yeah, yeah, no.
You know, I didn't have anything that really attracted me to the American community, whereas there was a community house, an American community house that did plays and things like that. My mother and my sister liked to be in those plays and so on. And I was really never interested in that.
Did you ever feel like you weren't completely accepted by this community or no?
By the Americans? Oh, yeah, because my mother was an accepted member of the community and my sister there, okay. and all they knew was that I was off playing tennis while they were doing their thing in the American community.
What language was spoken in your home?
Well, both. With my sister to this day, we speak Spanish to each other.
Really?
With my mother, we always spoke English.
How was her Spanish?
My mother's?
Yeah.
Well, very good.
Yeah, yeah.
Very good. I mean, the strong accent, I'm not going to take this, I'm just... Oh, well, it's just a dentist.
Yeah, yeah.
I will be there tomorrow morning. Thanks. Bye.
Who were your mother's friends in the community?
Well, they were essentially American executives of companies. Like, for example, the Edgecombs were, that's E-D-G-E, C-O-M-B-E, Ralph, and...
I have the Anglo-American directory. I can look it up.
Yeah, Ralph and Edgecombe. They were, but he was. I think the general manager of Texaco in Cuba.
Wow. So they were close friends with your mother.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And Bennett Carlisle Bennett and his wife Laurie or Laura Bennett. And Coster, until she died, Susie Coster, C-O-S-T-E-R, and very good friends were the Crosbys, Kenneth Crosby, who became vice president of Merrill Lynch.
Right.
He was the general manager of Merrill Lynch in Havana, and his wife, I don't know what her real name was. Everybody called her Cricket. His first wife, she died of cancer in Cuba. And my mother, who had been a nurse in Cuba, she was not so much a nurse as an English teacher. She took care of her. Her last 2 weeks, she was there by her bedside all the time, and Ken Crosby later became vice president of Merrill Lynch, and was in Washington D.C. He was the head of Merrill Lynch in Washington D.C. Wow. He's since passed away. I mean, they were my mother's age.
His name keeps coming up because I think he was pretty influential in terms of organizing investment and business. And
yeah, and he also had CIA connections.
And CIA connections.
Yeah, he had CIA connections, very definitely. He told me this many years later in D.C.
Yeah.
He and I had lunch when I was working. I originally worked at the Brookings Institution in Washington.
Sure.
And from there, I went to the OAS. And when I was at the OAS, He would invite me to have lunch at different places. And I know that it was to discuss Cuba because I was following Cuba very closely.
What years for this?
Well, this was all prior to 88.
Okay.
And because I left the OAS in like December of 88.
Yeah.
And so Ken Crosby liked to invite me to lunch and pump me.
Wow.
And I don't know whether he told me flat out.
Yeah.
That he was with the CIA, but I had met with some CIA guys at a conference in the State Department at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research. And I told him about that, and he says, yeah, I know.
Wow.
And so on. So, I mean, yeah.
Wow. What was their project? I mean, what were they trying to accomplish at that time? So China...
It seemed to me that their big concern, their major concern, was that Raul would die before Fidel. Because they had a better opinion of Raul than of Fidel.
Really?
They considered Fidel a bit crazy, whereas Raul was more rational.
Wow.
And I say this because I was invited about 7 or 8 times to participate in conferences. Well, they weren't conferences, they were just meetings by the Bureau of Intelligence and Research and the State Department, which is a CIA-funded outfit. And essentially, they would invite 8 or 10 academics mainly, mm-hmm. although all of us weren't academics. I wasn't
sure.
considered an academic, even though I was doing a lot of academic research at the time. And the technique that they used was they had developed like 5 scenarios for Cuba, and for each one they would want us to discuss it in terms of feasibility of that scenario coming about and what were the implications for the national security of the United States.
Wow.
And the scenario that gave people the most fits was Raul dying before Fidel.
Wow. Wow. Who were these other intellectuals who had come to this?
Well, one guy was Jaime Suchliki at the University of Miami. He was there in one.
Right.
I mean, I was invited to, like I said, 8 or 10, but the group changed.
Sure.
And there may have been 1 or 2 others that I knew, but he is the only one that I really can recall at this time. And, you know, we weren't sworn to secrecy or anything like that. And lo and behold, the Spanish CIA got wind of this. And they invited me to go to Madrid and debrief them.
Wow.
Which I did.
Yeah.
Which I did.
Wow.
They were very interested in the technique, and they were very interested in the type of discussion that was taking place. At that time, I think I was in Madrid maybe 1990. It's my recollection, 1990, 1991.
Okay.
So the Soviet bloc had crumbled.
The beginning of the special period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think the only, I guess, halfway interesting thing that I could think of at that time was that they felt that Raul would go at any moment because he drank so much.
Got it. Wow.
I remember one of the directors of their CIA, which is CECID, or it was CECID, C-E-C-I-D, at the time. She said, well, what do you know about Raul Castro's health? And I said, well, I don't know anything about his health other than that they say that he has been really an alcoholic most of his life. Why? And she, it was a woman director, she said, I think his liver is pate.
Wow. Yeah.
That was 91, 92. Well.
Right.
Here we are, imagine, here we are, 20.
His liver seems okay. Yeah, wow. What did you do with the OAS?
I was chief economist at OAS.
Wow.
I did a lot of economic studies of Latin American and Caribbean countries, mainly Venezuela.
Okay. Was our presence in Venezuela at its height anything like it was in Cuba? Because I'm trying, yeah.
Probably, yeah. You know, probably. It's possible that the American colony wasn't as big and strong. But look, oil. And most of the oil was exploited, marketed by American companies. I mean, Royal Dutch Shell was not American per se, but all the others were. And I know that the American Venezuelan Chamber of Commerce was a pretty powerful outfit in Venezuela. I have a hard time comparing, mainly because when I left Cuba at age 18, so really wasn't paying
right.
all that much attention to these things as I did later in Venezuela. But in Venezuela, the U.S. investment was massive.
Yeah.
When I went to Venezuela, furthermore, I deal with Venezuelans, people in the government, academics, and so on, not with Americans.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I know that there was a lot of presence.
Sure. Sorry that we're getting sidetracked. It's just really interesting tidbits that I'm interested in. Because, I do think there was something exceptional, just from what I know about Latin America, which isn't, it's learned differently, certainly, than yours. I know we had a ton of investment in Venezuela, but I never imagined the American community as diversely formed, where you have institutions, cultural institutions, semi-political, right.
Cuba was a far more developed country than Venezuela, yeah. Forgetting per capita income, which is distorted in the case of Venezuela because of the oil.
Right, right.
Okay, so forgetting that, Cuba was a far more developed country. There were a lot more indigenous industries in Cuba than there were in Venezuela.
Okay.
In Venezuela, what was the most popular ketchup? Del Monte.
Right. Right.
Okay. What was the most popular? What liquor was the number one volume seller? Scotch whiskey.
Wow. Okay.
And per capita terms, Venezuela at one time was number one per capita consumer of Scotch whiskey in the world.
Wow.
Okay, so people, in Venezuela, there was much more of a culture of foreign products are better than ours.
Yeah.
Okay, in Cuba, there was some of that, but nowhere near as much.
Yeah.
Wow.
If you look at anthologies of literature, of Latin American literature, you'll see that the Venezuelan representation is much smaller than you would expect for a country that size,
mm-hmm.
even population-wise. Cuba, on the other hand, is super represented. I mean, it would not be wrong to say that intellectual life in Cuba was far richer than it ever was in Venezuela. One of the richest in Latin America, one of the poorest in Latin America.
Wow.
So it's a real contrast. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And I know this because when I started studying the economy of Venezuela when I was at the OAS, I took it upon myself to try to really get to know the country. Mm-hmm. You know, its literature, its
sure.
its history, and so on.
Yeah.
So it unfortunately is a country in Latin America with one of the poorest cultural background.
Wow. All right. Sorry, we can return Cuba. No, this is all very helpful though, and it's making. I'm reading right now. I'm reading Boris Goldenberg's book.
Oh yeah.
Have you read this? Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
It's good.
I have it. Boris Goldenberg was a very kind of a strange guy, very severe guy. He was a teacher at Ruskin Academy.
Yeah, no.
I remember him well.
That's what I picked it up for, and, you know, everybody was very impressed with him, right?
Yeah. So I never took a course with him because he was in the high school part and I was in the bachillerato part.
So why were you in the bachillerato?
Because it offered bachillerato and high school degrees.
You didn't know where you were.
I was more geared to my Cuban friends and
were
Cuba
you Cuban? In your own identity? How did you identify?
Yeah, Cuban American, but both.
Sure.
You know, if we were speaking Spanish here, you wouldn't guess that I speak English.
Well, yeah. yeah.
I grew up bilingually.
Yeah. So, that's true with Harry Skilton too, I think.
Yeah. Harry Skilton. Same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys.
Except that Harry hasn't maintained the Spanish,
right?
As I have because of working at the Organization of American States and Inter-American Development Bank. So I wrote a lot in Spanish.
Oh wow!
You see?
Yeah. Do you still have a Cuban accent that when you?
Oh sure.
It? Yeah.
And I taught a lot all over Latin America. I taught probably in every single country in Latin America.
And what were you teaching?
Project design.
Okay. Yeah. Through the OAS or through the International Development Bank?
Inter-American Development Bank.
Inter-American Development Bank. That's right. So who are your friends in Cuba? Tell me about your social network.
They were all revolving around tennis, mainly.
Okay.
So my best friend at that time was Jack Conil. C-O-N-I-L-L. Jack was Cuban, but I think he had an English grandfather, something like that. Anyhow, he lives in Fort Lauderdale. And he went to La Salle, by the way. He went to La Salle. But he was a very good tennis player.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I were big pals. We won a lot of tournaments together.
You played doubles? Yeah.
We played doubles. We played singles. We played doubles. Yeah.
Did you play for a club as well or no?
In Cuba?
Yeah.
Not really. Not really. I played at the Villanova University tennis courts.
Okay.
Which were very, very good tennis courts, clay tennis courts.
Sure.
But there wasn't all that much interclub play in Cuba. We played tournaments, not so much interclub matches.
Did you belong to one of the big five or no?
Well, we at one time belonged to the Club de Profesionales, but then we moved out near Villanova University.
Okay.
And so we dropped that membership.
How about your mother and your sister? Did
they dropped that membership. They were with the American Colony, the Community House, the Mother's Club. There was a Mother's Club.
Did you go to that ever or no?
Well, maybe once or twice.
Yeah.
It's funny, you know, whenever I think about it, we had very separate lives. Look at that rain out there.
It is just so amazing.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful.
So we had such separate lives.
You and your mother and your
sister. Yeah, my sister.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was your impression of, I mean, because it sounds like you sort of divorced yourself from this community in some ways. Like you were a part of it, you were accepted by it, it was a safe place for you, sure, but you chose another. Did you think negatively about the American presence?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Okay.
When I was smaller, I'd go with my mother and my sister. But once I started getting serious about tennis, then I wanted to go to bed early.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to get up the next day very early and play very early.
Yeah.
Whereas my mother and my sister would be out at the community house or with some friends and so on.
How old were you at this time?
Between 11 and...
Through high school.
Yeah.
And, wow. Were you planning on going to the University of Havana?
No, I never was. I always really planned to go to the university in the U.S.
Okay.
So
then it's interesting for me that you took bachillerato.
Well, but it was an American school.
Russell so it didn't, Academy. It didn't matter, yeah.
And bachillerato was tougher than high school.
Yeah.
I'll just give you an idea. In my class, in bachillerato, I was one of the dumbest. And I got a 797 in the advanced math college boards. Okay. Four got 800s.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
Okay. I mean, it was a very, very, very demanding school.
Sure.
But bachillerato had more subjects. We were ahead of the high school in math, especially.
Mm-hmm. Do you count in Spanish or in English?
It depends on the language that I'm writing in. I guess in the last 15 or 20 years, mostly in English.
Yeah. My impression of the bachillerato program was that it was designed to send students to the University of Havana. Is that incorrect? I mean, to get into a college. So you had a degree.
I don't think so.
Okay.
And the reason I don't think so is because the history of the University of Havana is a very difficult history, politically and so on. Maybe to go to the University of Villanova.
Okay.
But doubtful to the University of Havana. I'm guessing.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've never asked that question to anybody. But my guess is that we were being prepared to go to the University of Havana.
Okay. But you graduated with both a high school and a bachillerato degree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And not everybody who was in the bachillerato program did that. Is that?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
There were no Americans in the Bachillerato program, were there?
Not to my knowledge.
Not, I mean, when I say Americans,
I don't
I mean 100%.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. When did you become aware that a revolution was happening?
Well, probably in 1956 or 57. Yeah, don't know that. Sure. My wife is back there.
Okay.
She can take that. Can you take that?
Yes.
Probably 56 or 57, maybe even before. There was a very well-known guy in Cuba, Pelayo Cuervo was his name. Pelayo, P-E-L-A-Y-O. And his last name was Cuervo, C-U-E-R-V-O. And he was assassinated in a lot, or killed, by the Batista secret police in the lot in back of our house.
Wow.
And I remember hearing that shot, and I don't remember when that was. It was probably 56 or 57. But we knew that things were going on, and we were an anti-Batista household. As a matter of fact, one very, very good friend of my father's, his name was Gonzalo Guel. Gonzalo with a Z, G-O-N-Z-A-L-O, and his last name was G-U-E-L-L, Guel with a diaresis. He was Secretary of State of Cuba. And he was very good friend of my father. My mother.
So before, so during the Prio government or during the Grau government?
Well, this was since, because I think Gonzalo Will was like he was a very high-ranking diplomat for Cuba in New York, and I think that's where they could have been Washington,
New York,
and that's where they made the connection.
Yeah.
Okay. And in 56 or 57, he was either Secretary of State or Prime Minister
under Batista,
and my mother invited him and his wife to dinner, and they came, and I blasted the guy. My mother was very embarrassed. I blasted him.
You blasted Guel, or you blasted,
well,
yeah.
I blasted him for being a Batista functionary, let's put it that way. And a couple of times, 26th of July, people see because my mother, her initial training was as a nurse, and people knew that. And a couple of times, wounded.
Wow.
People were taken to our house, where she dressed their wounds, and you know, that kind of thing. Very hush hush.
So your mother was political though, even though she's in.
No, she wasn't political.
So why would she help?
Because she knew that my sister and I.
So it's about you guys.
Yeah.
Was it your sister as well?
And she didn't like Batista, because I think she told me that my father never liked Batista.
All right.
Okay. I don't really know the history, the detailed history of when my father left Cuba on that fellowship to McAllen Field in Texas, but it may have happened right about the time of the revolt of the sergeants, the so-called
33-34.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It might have happened right around then.
Wow. Wow. Do you guys, do you and your sister think that you politicized your mother in some ways? I mean, would have she been active in the same ways that she was?
No. She was never really interested in politics.
So she helped these people sort of on your behalf?
Humanitarian.
Yeah.
Humanitarian.
But she wasn't helping SEAM agents.
She wasn't helping what?
Agents of SEAM. Or,
oh, SEAM.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't have been
brought. Okay. You're right. You're right. Got it. Yeah.
I think she was mainly being humanitarian. Concerned. She was never interested in politics. Not in the United States.
Were you interested in politics of the United States?
Oh yeah, always.
Even when you were in Cuba.
I kind of vaguely remember Nixon's trip. And how they pelted him with eggs and so on in 58. I don't think I was really very political.
Got it. But you had strong opinions about Batista.
Yeah.
Yeah. And your sister as well?
Yes.
Okay. Because it's interesting. I'm trying to... A lot of the Americans I talked to seem to have not cared. Some of them cared, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of them seemed very oblivious to what was going on. Is that because of your kind of mixed identity that you feel like you were maybe more invested, or is it...
Well, there were people who played tennis who were reporting abuse and things of that nature. My sister didn't see that as much as I did, but she pumped me for stories.
Got it. Wow. So in some ways, your isolation from the Anglo-American community gave you access to...
Well, I don't know whether it gave me access, but I certainly dedicated my time. I rarely spent any time with Americans.
Right.
I mean, from time to time, I accompany my mother to something. But over 90% of my interactions were with Cubans.
Did you ever speak about political events with the Americans at school?
I don't recall.
Okay.
I don't recall.
Because it's interesting to me that 1959, even though these people are largely apolitical, I would say, or they're thinking about American politics, right? They haven't invested themselves in the same way that I think the Cuban population had in this movement. Most of them are celebrating the ousting of Batista in 59, January 1st, 59 at least.
Yes.
And I'm trying to understand how they got to that place, because he was a friend of the American community in a lot of ways.
Well, I guess he was a friend of business, but the problem is that he had people working for him who were really criminals. I mean, the chief of police was a criminal. He enjoyed killing and torturing people. Of course, pictures of this were only published after Batista left. But these guys, Esteban Ventura and this guy Carratalá, you know, I mean, they were. I'll tell you something that was amazing, and I didn't find out about this until 59, okay. But there was a guy who played a pretty good game of tennis, much older than I. This guy was a colonel in the police force. His name was Enrique Perez Chomont. And that guy, we later found out, loved to torture people through their eyes. As a matter of fact, he had a nickname that was something like Ojo Verdes or Ojo Lindos or something like that. Okay, and he was one of the main torturers, and this guy, very distinguished, played tennis at the yacht club, fancy yacht. I remember he gave a tremendous cocktail party at the yacht club, a club that Batista couldn't be a member of.
I heard
because,
that, sir. Yeah.
And Pérez Chaumont gave Andrés, not Enrique, his name was Andrés Pérez Chaumont. And he gave a tremendous cocktail party there. He was dressed in his gala uniform. So this was in 58. I don't know how late in 58, but it was in 58. Didn't know until a couple of months afterwards that he was a torturer. I had no clue.
Wow. Was he gone by that point, or?
I'm sorry?
Was he gone by that point, or did he get?
Yeah, I don't know what happened to him. Yeah. I have no idea what happened to him.
Wow.
He spoke English. I think he had some part of his education in this country.
Did you ever do anything to support the revolution? Not really.
No, I was too young.
Yeah.
I really didn't do anything.
Yeah. Do you know Ed Gonzalez? He went to school with you, I think.
Eduardo Damaso Gonzalez.
I think
so.
Yeah,
sure.
He lives in Pennsylvania now.
He lives near Philadelphia.
Okay. Because he told me he was handing out flyers. His story reminds me of your story. It's all a mixed marriage where the father passed away very young, and then
it's interesting. His father, Eduardo Gonzalez, was the general manager of the largest sugar mill in Cuba.
Delicia, or which one?
Jarano.
Jarano.
And I think that just to give you an idea of size, that sugar mill in sugar season used to put out 1,025,000 sacks of sugar a day.
Wow.
1,025,000 sacks of sugar. They lived in Jarano in Camagüey province. And about 1952, it must have been 52, 53, Ed Sr. died. And Eddie's mother and so on didn't know what to do. And she came with her two girls and two boys to Havana. And somebody immediately said, well, you have to go see Ruth Montalban.
Oh, wow.
And she immediately did. I'll never forget the day that they came to her house because she was crying. Poor thing was a wreck.
Mm-hmm.
So we became friends of the family. June, the oldest daughter, she lives in Coral Gables.
Oh, wow.
She married a British guy, Raymond Frost, and Raymond Frost wrote a book that you might look up, but I can't remember the title of the book.
He lived in the community.
He was in a very good position at the World Bank in D.C., but he was a Britisher.
Right, but he lived in Cuba as well.
I don't remember that.
So, what was there this community of American wives who had married Cuban men? I mean, I'm trying to understand the contours of it, because it's interesting that they would say go to the Montalbans because they've experienced this before.
Well, because my mother was a youngish widow. at the time. So they put her in touch with my mother because of the commonality of situations.
Would have your mother recommended Rustin?
Well, I'm sure she did.
Yeah.
And Eddie went to Rustin.
Right, right. That's how I got its name.
And I think Billy did too.
Yeah.
Now, Nancy and June, I think they were beyond high school. I just don't remember. 52, maybe not. 52 or 53, I can't remember when.
Because I think the kids were already in boarding school at Candler and Buena Vista at that point.
Maybe, yeah. That's Candler College.
Yeah. At least Ed was at Candler.
Yeah.
I don't know about the girls, but yeah. No, it's interesting to me because there were so many. I'm looking through the 59 Anglo-American directory, and of the 1,000 or so, or it was the 1961 that I was looking at this one, and that matters, I guess, because after the revolution, a lot of people left immediately. But of the 1,000 or so Americans that are listed in Havana, something like 200 of them are in mixed marriages.
Uh-huh.
And that's a significant number.
Well, Ed Gonzalez.
Yeah.
The father. I think he went to Harvard.
Right, it was something.
I think he got an engineering degree from Harvard.
Right.
Or whatever. And so maybe he met Ann there. Could have been.
I think that's right.
Met Ann in Boston.
Yeah.
And my father met my mother in Baltimore, Washington.
Sure.
Probably Washington. So there were Cubans who were studying in this country, and that's probably the origin of those mixed marriages.
Yeah. I mean, but it's just, and these Cubans then after the revolution, López Fresquet, and Pazos, and...
But which Pazos? Felipe.
The one who was in the government right afterwards.
Oh, Felipe.
Felipe. They both married American women.
No,
Felipe?
No, Felipe didn't.
But he studied in the United States or something.
Not much. The thing is that he was research director at the IMF.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But I don't think he studied in the U.S. If he did, maybe he did a quick postgraduate or something like that. They're very good friends of ours.
Are they?
Ooh, yeah. Super good friends.
They were very good friends, or they're currently very?
Well, currently because their daughter, the youngest, Sara Maria, they were our next door neighbors in Washington for 30 years.
Wow.
And I knew her not well at Rustin. She went to Rustin.
Yeah.
And Felipito,
yeah,
who was in The Old Man and the Sea, he went to Rustin.
Right. It's just interesting to me because there was this comfort, I think, that the American colony had with the initial government of the revolution in some ways because of these connections also.
Well, probably Ruffo had most to do with that.
Right.
His family was part of the American colony, was certainly considered part of the American colony. I don't think the Pasos were.
How about the San Genes? Yeah.
It's to call San Genes.
San Genes, all right. I talked to Michael when I was in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a very interesting guy.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. When did you start to feel like I need to go someplace else? When did your family start to... after the revolution happens?
Well, I mean, I was always planning to come to school in this country.
Yeah.
So
It wasn't, but for your mother left, I'm guessing. Yeah.
She left in 61. She stayed behind because she thought that that system couldn't last.
Okay.
So she left in May 61. She hung on.
So after
May 61.
Bay of Pigs.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That must have been intense for her. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, May 61.
Did she tell you about that experience?
Yes. I'll tell you a funny story. She applied for a job at USIA,
mm-hmm.
U.S. Information Agency. And so she filled out the application and all that. The post that she eventually got was English teaching consultant, and they sent her throughout the world to give methodological seminars to teachers of English to speakers of other languages, TESOL.
Okay,
she was a great TESOL expert. Anyhow, she had her her security interview after putting in the application. She had the security interview and with two guys, I think two FBI guys. And so one of them said, well, here online, whatever, the application, you didn't fill in reason for leaving, say you were employed at the Cuban American Cultural Institute in Havana. But you didn't put reason for leaving. And she said, well, I didn't know what to write. And he said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, I drove to the Institute one day and I saw a militiaman standing in front of it with a machine gun and I kept on driving.
Wow.
And never went back.
Wow. 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 And that was in 1961 or when was?
I don't know.
So she taught English at the Institute then?
Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit more about this? I know it was run by Portillo...
Portel Vilá. Herminio Portel Vilá.
He was a historian, right?
Herminio Portel Vilá was a historian. He was a history professor at the University of Havana.
I've read a little bit of his stuff, yeah.
Well, he was a prolific writer.
Right, right.
And... so I think he established the Instituto Cultural Cubano Americano. Now, why and how he established that, I don't know. It may have been part of a movement on the part of the United States government, State Department, whether it's State Department, USIA, or who, but you know. Ex-American cultural institutes in different countries of the world.
Yes.
They have them.
Yeah.
Elsewhere or had them elsewhere. So I don't know the story behind the establishment of the Instituto Cultural Cubano, Cubano Norteamericano, I think it was called. But he established it, and I don't... Oh, well, she had been a student of his at the University of Havana because she took courses at the University of Havana. She took courses in linguistics. Then she got a master's in linguistics at Georgetown.
After the revolution?
Yes. And she was always off throughout her life. She was a very fine student. And so he hired her
wow.
as a teacher at the Cuban American Cultural Institute
wow.
in Havana. Yeah. Yeah. And they remained friends. I mean, I remember to our little house in Arlington, I remember him coming, and now we're talking well into the 60s.
Well, what's he like? I'd love to hear more about him.
A very severe but humorous at the same time guy. I don't know whether he was humorous with me and not with other people, but I was always maybe a rebellious kid, and so I'd try to, you know, these adults, I'd try to, you know, pinch them here and there. And he liked it. You know, he liked it. So, you know, so we got along very well. But he was a very severe guy. And he became very, very right-wing. And it's interesting because he had a hard time coming to this country. Actually, my mother helped him come here and become employed. I don't know how. I don't know the details of that. But you see, he, because of his earlier writings, was conceived in some quarters as being anti-American.
Yeah.
Okay. He wrote a history book that was Historia de Cuba y sus relaciones con Estados Unidos, or some title like that. And he was very very pro defense of Cuba as a republic vis-a-vis the American intervention and all of that. So there were people in the US government that because I think that he because my mother helped him. Or one of the reasons is that my mother helped him. I think he had a contract with Voice of America. I think.
All right. Do you remember him before the revolution? Or not really?
Not really.
Okay. Did you ever visit your mother at the Institute?
No.
No. All right. What did she do there? She just taught English?
Taught English.
Okay. What was, do you know anything about what her classes were like, or no?
But you know, she was very apolitical. Always throughout her life, she was very apolitical. She was interested in arts, literature, music, history. She had no interest in politics at all. I don't even recall a conversation about politics with her.
Wow. Was your mother the only American in her classes at the University of Havana?
I don't know.
Okay. Do you remember when she was going there or not really?
Yes. She went there like between 52 and 54. Something like that.
Got it. What did you think about the tourism in Cuba? Were you aware of it? Were you?
Sure. One day I was near the tennis club. A little quick story that I'll never forget. I was near the tennis club, walking along the street, and this woman comes up to me and says, "¿Dónde puedo coger la guagua?" I said, "Guagua." I said, "What's the guagua?"
You said in English. Yeah.
I said, "What's the guagua?" And she laughed and she said, I'd just like to know where the bus stop is around here. Because we used to call buses guaguas.
Yeah.
You know? So, but she said, "Wowway." I said, "Wowway, what the heck is Wowway?" And so that's one thing that I remember very well. And I mean, I never stopped to really talk to tourists or anything like that. But yeah, sure, I remember tourists. I mean, there were hotels all around. So
Yeah, was there any, like, some of the people I talked to, and because this project is trying to encompass the entire community, I've talked to a lot of, like, missionaries as well, and they were in some ways very ashamed of some of the activities of the tourists.
Well, Cuba was certainly a place where sexual tourism was certainly a part of the pie, of the tourism pie. I don't know what size, relative size, that slice was, but it was certainly part of the tourism pie. And the uncomfortableness of people, well, they would have had to be older than I. I'm 74. They would have had to be, I think, mostly older than I in order to remember that. But there was an incident that happened, I'm not sure exactly what year. It wasn't while I was alive, it was before I was born, where some American sailors pissed on the statue of Jose Martí downtown.
Yeah.
Well, it was 44, I was born in 42, so, but
I'm not sure about that.
And maybe that also, and of course, Meyer Lansky was the money behind the Riviera Hotel, which was a hotel built in like 55, 56, 57, near the American Embassy in Havana. So, sure, there was a lot of that, but I...
Were you aware of it? I mean, did you guys go out to the clubs?
And there was a club relatively near my house, which was the Biltmore,
right.
The Havana Biltmore Yacht and Country Club. And there were quite a few Americans that were members there. But I can't say that I remember the place being swamped with tourists.
Yeah.
It was only later when I started traveling, when I was 16, 17, 18, started traveling, playing tennis in different places, that from time to time I would come, on the flights, I would come across tourists and sexual tourists.
Yeah. And you could identify that.
Well, I mean, I remember on a flight from Miami to Havana, or from Havana to Miami, one or the other. I remember this very vivacious young American woman sitting next to a much older guy, and we started talking, and I could figure right away,
yeah,
that you know that. A, she wasn't his wife, and B, they had had a fling.
Right. Yeah, I think my grandmother on my father's side, like a man, invited her to Havana because this was a thing.
Sure.
Yeah. But and then she didn't realize what was happening until. All right. Was there ever a point where you felt like you didn't belong when the last time you were in Cuba, or even before the revolution, you always felt like there was a place for you.
Oh, yeah.
Was there ever a time where you felt like the Americans didn't belong?
No.
Okay. Where do you think the anti-Americanism of the revolution sort of came from?
Well, it certainly came from the lower classes. It didn't come from there. It came from Fidel and his people, Che, and so on. I mean, let's face it, the guy had a lot of charisma, at the time, and I think he whipped it up, and there were income distribution problems in Cuba. Whoever says that there weren't it just is not reality.
Sure.
And so he had a ready an audience there that was ready and willing to listen, you know, to all of this, and who backed and approved the nationalizations, and there were quite a lot of people who benefited from Americans just leaving their houses, leaving the keys, literally leaving the keys, and taking over those houses, apartment buildings, you know, what have you. So, and there were a lot of people who came from the interior of Havana, mm-hmm. At that time who benefited because of, you know, they, even if they were living in a garage, they had it better than what they had before in the countryside.
Sure.
At the time. So there was a very serious problem of income distribution. A lot of people deny that, but it's simply not real. There are studies in the 1950s that show, I mean, there's plenty of evidence to show skewed income distribution in Cuba. So, and by the way, I was told that this was one of the main reasons that my father and some of his sisters kind of renounced the Catholic Church. Because they felt that the Catholic Church was not doing its job of protecting the downtrodden and ministering to the downtrodden. And certainly that, you know, I had four aunts, sisters of my father's, who survived all that time. They only started passing away in the 1980s mm-hmm. and 1990s. They were older than he was. And three of the four were very much for the revolution until they died. I mean, throughout.
But they lived in the United States.
No, they stayed in Cuba. They stayed in Cuba.
Oh, wow. Wow.
They stayed in Cuba.
Have you ever been back?
97.
97. Yeah.
97. They had all died. Those four aunts had already died. And I had a first cousin who had married a brigadier general in the Ministry of the Interior in Cuba.
Wow.
And she was left there. I mean, she was still there. So
yeah.
I visited her.
Yeah.
It was quite a visit.
I can imagine.
And as a result of that visit, one of her sons made it out of Cuba and lives in Aventura, Florida.
Wow. Wow.
Guy who's an artist.
Yeah. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, you know. Well, I mean, by now you've run across I don't know how many incredible stories.
Yeah, no, it's a fun topic. It's a tragic, fun, complicated, so many contours, and these interviews help me give it texture in a way.
A long time president. I'll give you two things. I don't know if anybody's commented to you. Probably the first one, but. A longtime president of the Inter-American Development Bank, Enrique Iglesias, Uruguayan guy. He once said to me, he said, Cuba is a Greek tragedy. He says, you know why I refer to it as a Greek tragedy? Because it ends badly.
Yeah.
And the other thing that impacted me is that an archbishop of Santiago de Cuba, Pedro Meurice, he's dead, he died quite a few years ago. He said that the Castro period is an anthropological wound.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Man.
I think those are all the questions I have. This is very helpful. And as you can see, you
were
very helpful.
Well, you can give me a ring.
Helpful.
I'm sorry?
You were very helpful. I know you didn't think you were going to be, but your career afterwards gives you a sort of perspective that nobody has had. And that was really fascinating for me, but also just your in and out of the community. And maybe you could help me think about this, but I'm trying to start my dissertation, I have to explain what this community was, right? So is Boris Goldenberg a part of this community?
That's a good question. That's a good question. Boris Goldenberg was a strange dude.
Okay.
In today's words.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a strange dude.
Yeah.
And I don't know what descriptions you have of him by people who actually were taught by him.
Yeah,
I'm sure he was good.
They all loved him, right? They all said my parents were scared I was going to become a communist, but there is some of that, right? But he seemed like a character. Yeah.
Yeah, he was. He was a strange dude. He was certainly very unlike all the other teachers at Ruston. I mean, he was a special case. Have you interviewed Chris Baker?
Yeah, multiple times, three times.
Yeah, because Chris would remember Goldenberg very well, and he probably would have some stories of how his father came upon Boris Goldenberg, if Jim Baker was the guy who hired him. I don't know.
He was.
I mean, Jim Baker was a guy who certainly hired the best.
Yeah.
I mean, he hired the best. I mean, the group of teachers at Ruston were very, very top-notch.
Did you ever have a class with the math teacher Ferrer or no?
Marta Ferrer, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard she was very...
Marta was a brain. She taught us math review, and that's and in that math review class of eight,
yeah,
four got 800s on the advanced math college boards.
Wow.
Marta Ferrer. The link, I have another link with Marta Ferrer. Her father was an ophthalmologist.
Oh, wow.
And a colleague of my father's.
Wow, wow. Wow. Were you in those, I know she like would take some students Saturday mornings.
That was the thing, yeah. That was math review. We called it math review.
You would do that. So, yeah, Skilton told me about that. And so,
yeah, we call it math review. It was 4 hours.
Yeah, and you had to take a test and answer one question every minute or something.
Yeah, well, because, she was training us for the college boards, college entrance examination.
And she would distract you on purpose.
Put her child on the
table is what Harry Skilton told me. I guess the child was older at that point.
Just between you and me, and don't write this down, and, But Marta Ferrer had bad breath.
Oh, man.
All she had to do with me is get close.
That'll be a distraction, yeah. But that really, Skilton said, to this day, this is the reason I could concentrate so well, because of, I don't lose things because of those lessons. But
yeah, Marta.
Did you have Neuendorf as well?
No, he was in high school.
Yeah.
In high school. But I remember him very well.
Yeah.
That's another strange dude.
Yeah. He was. John Malamphy, do you know that name?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He told me that the first exam he took for Neuendorf, he got a negative 25 or something, that was a real score that you could get.
Yeah. There were people, Baker brought in some real brains as teachers to that school. A few of them didn't pan out, okay? I had a guy who came in as a math teacher, and clearly that guy knew his math. I mean, clearly he knew his math, but he looked like a country bumpkin, and the student, and he talked like a country bumpkin. Mochacheto, dos más dos son cuatro. That kind of slow drawl.
Yeah.
You know, and he'd dress in these wide striped suits and two-tone shoes. he couldn't take it because too many students were making fun of him.
Wow.
But I know that the guy was excellent. I remember him. And there was one, La Doctora Esteban. But she was a communist. She was a communist through and through. I don't remember her with fondness because she knew that in bachillerato I was the best speaker of English in my class.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sure. And so she liked to have us read certain excerpts from a book. And when she'd come to an excerpt that would have an English name, she'd want me to read that excerpt so that she could correct me. And so if I said, porque vinieron de Washington, D.C., and I would say it like that because I knew it would bug her. Porque vinieron de Washington, D.C. Said, Washington, Montalban, Washington. Diga Washington.
Wow.
Washington, D.C., doctora.
Wow. Yeah.
But some very good teachers, some very, very fine teachers. That was a wonderful school.
What was your life after Cuba? Where'd you go to school?
Well, I went 1 year at Pomona College in California, where I was in the 3-2 program with Caltech.
Okay.
In engineering. Then I came to GW, and I got an MA in economics and an ABD in economics.
Wow.
All but dissertation.
Yeah, I know ABD very well.
You know, by that time, I had a wife and kid and just had to go to work.
Yeah, well, this project is exhausting if it makes you feel any better. The D part is very difficult.
Yes.
But anyway, I
took the comps.
Yeah, that part's difficult too.
Yeah, but I took them.
Yeah. Well, I can't thank you enough. This has been
really, my pleasure.
Really helpful for me. I'm going to get this transcribed.